Do you find yourself shaking your fist at the same old political talking heads? Well, stop. Join Kelly Goff, Josh Barrow, Gene Sperling, and thinkers from across the political spectrum for a live Left, Right, and Center. On October 20th, we'll turn your political frustration into fun. Don't go it alone this election year. Join us at the beautiful theater at the Ace Hotel in downtown L.A. For $15 tickets, go to kcrw.com/LRCLive.
Kershaw for the save. Two on and two out. This is a game that's going to be remembered for a very long time. The pitch to Defoe. Swung on and missed. Strike three. Dropped by Ruiz. Throws to first. And the Dodgers are going to Chicago as Clayton Kershaw, in his first relief appearance in 7 years, records the save. The Dodgers come from behind and beat the Nationals 4-3 to win the National League Division Series 3-2.
Dodger pitcher Clayton Kershaw eking out a Game 5 victory against the Washington Nationals last night. We'll talk about what's next for the Boys in Blue coming up in the program. But first, a subject even closer to home. Literally, housing affordability and homelessness are among the most urgent crises facing Los Angeles right now. That has led to not one, but three ballot measures coming up in November and then in March. Two take aim at developers. Backers say builders need to do more to lower housing costs. The third, put on the ballot by the city council, would raise property taxes to fund new housing for the homeless. Here to discuss all of that, I'm joined now by Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti. Welcome.
Thank you. And can I just say the Dodgers are amazing before we start the housing talk, too? That was an incredible game.
Yes,
go Dodger
you can.
Blue,
yay, go Dodgers.
Thank
okay.
You.
All right. Well, thank you. And let's start with Measure JJJ. And that is put on the November ballot by a group called Build Better LA. It would require some developers to use union labor for new buildings and to create some affordable housing in their developments. Are you for or against this measure?
I haven't taken a position on JJJ yet. I think there's a study that'll come out in the next couple of days, and a lot of that was created in a vacuum, so we don't know what the overall impact. Though I think the intention is good, which is to build more affordable housing. But both Measure JJJ and we're going to talk in a moment about the Neighborhood Integrity Initiative, to me, don't get to the core of the problem, which is both of them deal with those cases in which somebody is building something that needs an exemption or an exception. And it adds some rules so that when somebody needs the city to change some of the zoning to help them get their development, they add some well-intentioned but maybe negative things onto that. I'm waiting on JJJ, but the heart of this matter is whether or not we can build enough affordable housing and whether we have clear rules. So JJJ, I think we have to wait and see. I'm looking forward to the study that's going to come out. But anything that builds more affordable housing in general, I have absolutely been for, and I think that is the best part of what is in JJJ.
But what are you waiting for? The language is in the ballot measure.
Sure.
You've already taken a stand on the Integrity Initiative. That's on the March ballot. So why not say yes or no? There are just a few weeks left, and
so
people are voting already.
Yeah, of course. I love this is one of the problems of doing land use at the ballot box. But on JJJ, I love that when they're asking for an exemption, they say that you have to build more affordable housing. What I don't love about it is that a city council can waive that. So we all would agree, I think, if somebody's coming to the city and saying, I want to change the zoning to build something bigger than what's allowed or different than what's allowed, we should be able to extract some affordable housing out of that. But in it, it allows the city council to waive that. I trust the current city council not to do so, but that's the first piece that worries me. Second is in this, it would boost the wages, as you said, to what's called prevailing wage, something we all generally support, that people should be able to have good wages when they build things. But there's been very little formal analysis. Does that actually produce less affordable housing because it becomes more expensive to build or not? That's why I'm looking forward to Beacon Economics is a group that is actually looking at this for the first time, and I like to make an informed vote, and before I put my endorsement behind something, I want to make sure that we have the full information. This was done, without any of that analysis, and that should be coming out shortly.
Okay. Well, let's talk about that issue of the city council and its role in creating affordable housing. Do you think that the city council should require developers to supply a certain amount of housing before they approve a project, a certain amount of affordable housing?
I do support that any market rate housing should produce funding to build affordable housing, too. If you see luxury condominiums going up, that doesn't necessarily always help middle-class, working-class people. And so not only do I believe they should, I've introduced what's called a linkage fee. Most cities in California have it, and it's time for Los Angeles to have it, too. And I urge your listeners to contact their city council members to urge them to support it. Our study on that just came out. We are proposing, just as we do with parks or with schools, attaching a small fee to new housing development that we could put into a fund to build affordable housing. I think that builders could get out of that if they want to build it on site, meaning they could actually include those units in their own development. But even if they don't do that, as we see in San Diego, as we see in Oakland and San Francisco and San Jose and almost every other big city in California, we should put aside money to make sure that all the housing that's being built isn't just being built for those who are millionaires, but those who are regular middle-class residents of Los Angeles.
Okay, let's talk about Measure HHH, also on the November ballot, and that would provide housing for the homeless by raising property taxes. It needs a two-thirds vote to pass because it is a tax measure. That is historically hard to get in Los Angeles. Are you confident that this will pass? And if it doesn't, what next for dealing with the homeless crisis?
Well, I am very strongly behind Measure HHH. I'm one of the leaders of the campaign for it. And HHH, people say, why three letters? I've turned it into Housing Helps Homeless. And HHH would allow us to build $1.2 billion worth of housing that is not just apartments, but also the services that people who are homeless and struggling with homelessness need to overcome substance abuse and addiction issues, to deal with the mental health challenges that they often have, get job training or child care. And we have a 90%+ success rate when people are put in housing with that support around them. The reason so many homeless people often don't stay in housing, which they're lucky enough to get into housing, is they don't have that support. Or if they get that support on the streets, obviously they stay on the streets alive but without being housed. And while it is a property tax increase, it's only about $34 on the average house in Los Angeles. So for a few trips to Starbucks to be able to have 10,000 people housed, I'm very confident that the people of LA will pass this. Last point is, we're not just asking taxpayers to pay for this. The city has stepped up, and we put $138 million in our budget. We're leveraging more federal and county dollars than we ever have. And so we have stretched every last inch that we can in our own budget first. What we're saying is this will help us keep that momentum going for the next decade and look back to try to end chronic homelessness on the street. It is a moral outrage and my highest priority.
Right. Okay. So 10,000 units over 10 years. That sounds great, but it's not going to happen overnight. What needs to be done in the short term to get people off the streets? Is there a plan for that at all?
Yes, we actually passed the plan earlier this year, and we've begun implementing everything from HOPE teams, which are these amazing teams of police officers together with sanitation workers and social workers and homeless outreach workers who go together and get to know really the people on the street. Instead of, you know, police officers giving them a ticket and creating criminal records for them, they're actually helping them connect with services.
But where would they live? Where would they actually sleep at night?
So where they are already living, we've had hundreds of folks already with these HOPE teams, for instance, get into services, get a voucher for housing. We've done outreach to landlords, and we've folks who are listening who do own apartments, we need even more units. But we've been moving in hundreds of people over the last 2 years, actually over 9,000 people from the streets into permanent housing. Some of them just need a year, a voucher for an apartment, and they get their lives together and can move on. Others need a permanent place to live because they're dealing with much deeper issues of mental health or other substance abuse issues, et cetera. But we have quadrupled the number of outreach workers that are on the streets right now. We're bringing mobile showers to the community soon. So we have a very comprehensive plan with about 62 different strategies. Some of that's the city, some of that's the county, but I've never seen a coalition around homelessness as strong as this, including all the faith leaders who just endorsed HHH and are working very closely with us in mosques, synagogues, and churches across Los Angeles. And over 500 house parties were thrown just in the last 3 months to be able to put together move-in kits for people who are moving into housing. So people are really embracing this at their neighborhood level, where they live, getting to know the individuals who are homeless, the families that are on the streets. And that's what it's going to take, a combination of that funding and all of us becoming involved.
But can you forgive the average voter who drives through our city streets and sees homeless encampments everywhere and doesn't think that there's much being done about, or can't see that there's much being done to solve
this problem?
I
agree. It's what keeps me up at night. I go out with outreach teams and actually talk to these individuals and actually have helped many people get off the street. It has gotten worse for all sorts of reasons. Up and down the West Coast, a good economy has pushed people out of housing because more people have moved here. There's a lot of people who have gotten out of prison and jail without a social safety net to catch them. But if you look at 25,000 people, how do you begin to chip away at that? It's taken many years to get there. It will take some years to get out of there. But there is no question that I think anybody who's been active on this issue for years has never seen the number of resources, which just in pure dollars, there's $238 million more dollars from the county and city on this. A plan, never had there been passed a plan, a permanent committee on this in the city council. And I think this HHH measure, which really gives us a chance to continue that momentum that has started on our streets. We've almost ended homelessness among our veterans, for instance. So even as you see these encampments and see the tents, there's a lot of people that are moving off. If we can keep that going, I think we can end street homelessness in the coming years with really deliberate and continuing work.
All right. Eric Garcetti, Mayor of Los Angeles, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Donald Trump addressed supporters just minutes ago in North Carolina, responding to the accusations of women who say they have been groped by the presidential candidate without their consent.
As you have seen, right now, I am being viciously attacked with lies and smears. It's a phony deal. I have no idea who these women are. Have no idea. I have no idea. And I think you all know I have no idea because you understand me for a lot of years. Okay?
Well, the very latest accusation also came just moments ago as Trump was speaking from former Apprentice contestant Summer Zervis.
He then turned me around and said, "Let's lay down and watch some telly." He put me in an embrace, and I tried to push him away. I pushed his chest to put space between us. And I said, "Come on, man, get real." He repeated my words back to me, "Get real," as he began thrusting his genitals. He tried to kiss me again with my hand still on his chest, and I said, "Dude, you're tripping right now." Attempting to make it clear, I was not interested.
Summer Zervis accusing Donald Trump of sexual misconduct. She says the incident happened in 2007. So what has this election and this week in particular done for the women's movement and for women's politics? Joining us now is Chelsen Vicari. She's Evangelical Program Director for the Institute on Religion and Democracy. Welcome to you, Chelsen.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. Also, Catherine Spiller, who heads the Feminist Majority here in Los Angeles. Welcome to you, Catherine.
Thank you.
Okay, Chelsen, let's start with you. Your reaction to this latest accusation and to the last week's worth of accusations against Donald Trump.
The latest accusation is just heartbreaking to hear. Every woman out there who has had sexual harassment or some form of sexual assault can certainly understand the deepness and how personal this issue can be. As far as the tapes, I was just absolutely disgusted to hear what Donald Trump had to say, not only the TMZ tape, but the interviews with Howard Stern. Absolutely disgusting to hear. Just so sad.
Were you a supporter previously?
No, I have never been in Trump's corner.
Okay. And what about other evangelical leaders, other church leaders? What are they saying?
Sure. So there have been some evangelical men coming to Trump's defense, making excuses. We heard Pat Robertson recently say this was macho talk. That for so many evangelical women, this seems like a betrayal. This is even harder for us to hear. These are our church, our denominational leaders who are not coming to women's dignity and defense. We want our leaders to have integrity, and we do feel like they are trading in women's dignity for the sake of some kind of conquest of power, and it's not something we're standing for.
And are you a Hillary Clinton supporter?
I'm not. I'm going to be voting for an independent candidate this year.
Okay. And Catherine, on the other side, I imagine your reaction is uniformly negative to what you've heard in the last week?
Oh, no question about it. But I think it just shows you, not only has Trump had a long history of disrespecting women and disparaging remarks for women, and, you know, so many of the Republican leaders who, and some evangelical leaders, although, as Chelsea said, too many of them remain supporters. But even those who have denounced Trump and unendorsed Trump, you know, the question we have to ask them all is, what took you so long? You know, this is not the first time that we have seen Donald Trump's words about women, and the accusations against him have been well known for a long time. It just shows you that, you know, not only does he not have any respect for women, but too many of the Republican leadership don't either.
And so do you see this as a turning point then in terms of how women are galvanized politically, or is this just a moment now in the campaign?
I think this is a turning point, and I think you're going to see a massive women's vote against Donald Trump and for Hillary Clinton in these November elections, and for other candidates who have always stood and been fighters for women. Again, you know, Donald Trump is a creation of the Republican Party and the Republican leadership. Even though some of them want to now distance themselves from him, they've long shown no respect for women. They've blocked equal pay law from going into effect. They voted against the Violence Against Women Act, which would have addressed sexual assault on college campuses with new resources. They voted against providing family planning funding for women. So this is a party that has long disrespected women, and Trump has just brought it all to the surface. And I think, you know, some of them are embarrassed. Too many of them took way too long to divorce themselves from him. And some, as Chelsea said, continue to support him, which is, it must be very dispiriting for Republican women activists.
So, Chelsea, is it dispiriting for you to see this, to see, as you said, some of the leaders support Donald Trump? You said it was dispiriting for you, and yet that support does not go to the woman in the race, Hillary Clinton. Is that for other political reasons?
Absolutely. So I still believe that policy is most important here when I'm looking at just who I'm going to vote for president. Of course, his character absolutely counts. So that's not to say character counts. But when I'm looking across the aisle, then if I can't vote for Donald Trump because his character is diabolical, then I want to look across the aisle. I do share concerns with other evangelicals about a Clinton presidency, so I have to look elsewhere. Thankfully, there are other independent candidates to look towards. But yes, it goes back to I'm a church analyst, so I focus solely on religion, and I do want to see all evangelicals coming together and saying this character counts when picking a president, as we've always said, and it doesn't matter what side of the political aisle the individual is on. And I don't know that I'm seeing that, and that's going to hurt Christians' future witness for generations to come. We have millennials who are becoming nuns, who are leaving the church, nuns as in N-O-N-E-S, leaving the faith. And so this isn't helping. This isn't helping as far as the concern that religious leaders have about millennials leaving the church. It's something we see all the time. But this is why a lot of young millennials are saying this is hypocrisy, and you have to actually stand by your words no matter what partisan politics you're playing.
Well, do you see this as a turning point for women's political action and for feminism on your side?
Well, in the church, as far as Christianity goes, there is disagreement on what women's roles look like. But as far as respecting the dignity of women, Christianity teaches that every human being is made in the image of God and everyone has equal value. So I want to see women's voices continue to be heard among their male peers. What's happened is that so many of these men who are supporting Trump haven't had the experiences of sexual assault or sexual harassment. They're not able to empathize and understand. I hope that they will start to listen to the women around them in their congregations, the women in their families. 1 in 5 women are sexually assaulted. I know they each know someone who has been sexually assaulted, a woman who they need to start listening to their voices. I do hope it's a turning point as far as the church listening to women who have been hurt or who have equal experiences in politics and policy. Absolutely. These are conversations we should be having, and I'm glad we're having them under unfortunate circumstances.
Madeline, there's a problem with what Chelsen is saying, though, is that the evangelical leaders who are all men are continuing to stand by, most of them stand by Donald Trump. And for the women who are evangelicals and who are active in their churches to vote for another third-party candidate is to throw away their votes. It's not even to send a message. There's only one of two people who are going to be elected president of the United States. It will either be Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton. The other candidates in the race have no chance. So to throw away your vote when you should be sending a message to the male leadership of the evangelical movement, they're going to vote for Donald Trump. They're not listening to you. They're not denouncing him. They're saying it's more important that they vote for him than they respect the women in their movement. So I think the best way to send a message for Chelsen and other women would be to vote for Hillary Clinton. She's never been accused of sexual harassment or of sexual assault. In fact, she's been a fighter for women on these issues. That is indisputable. And she should get their vote to send a message to the male leaders of the evangelical movement that we're not going to put up with this.
Okay, we'll have to end it there. We're out of time, unfortunately. Catherine Spiller heads the Feminist Majority here in Los Angeles. Chelsen Vaccari, Evangelical Program Director for the Institute on Religion and Democracy. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Coming up, Outside Magazine says Australia's Great Barrier Reef is dead after a hard battle with climate change. But is it really? Some say not yet. We'll talk about that next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Select sessions from KCRW's music program Morning Becomes Eclectic can be experienced in the immersive world of virtual reality. Download KCRW's VR app to get lost in the music. Go to kcrw.com/VR.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. One of the world's great environmental treasures, the Great Barrier Reef in Australia, is dying. The 1,400-mile coral reef is a UNESCO World Heritage Site known for its incredible colors and biodiversity. You can even see it from space. But Outside Magazine recently declared it dead at the age of 25 million years. Well, some experts disagree, like Professor Andrea Grottoli from Ohio State University. She studies coral reefs and oceanography, and she's been to the Great Barrier Reef twice. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
The reef has been called the most important habitat in the ocean. Tell us about that. Why does it have that significance?
Well, coral reefs comprise about 0.2% of the surface area of the ocean, but house one-third of all marine species. So they have a disproportionate impact on the number of organisms that exist in the ocean.
All right. So let's talk about this Outside Magazine declaration that it is now pretty much all but dead. You disagree with that?
Well, dead, it is severely impacted right now. Particularly the top third of the Great Barrier Reef has seen the worst bleaching ever, and it was the healthiest part of the Great Barrier Reef before this. And so it has been severely impacted. But the central and southern parts of the Great Barrier Reef haven't been nearly as impacted. And so to say that the Great Barrier Reef is dead is a stark statement that I don't think is really supported by the observations. Now, that said, you know, the reefs in general are under serious stress because of continued bleaching events that are being driven by increases in global temperatures.
Mm, okay. And so when did that start to really take off, this killing off of the coral there?
From bleaching?
Yeah.
The first mass bleaching event that was recorded was the 1982-83 event that was associated with that El Nino as well. Mm-hmm. And there have since been others. This is now categorized as the third mass bleaching event that has happened globally, and it is the longest one on record.
Okay, so this is the largest living structure in the world, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And so what is at stake here when you have the top third, as you said, have the worst bleaching ever, that it seems to be struggling? What is at stake here if indeed more and more of it dies off?
Well, I mean, the Great Barrier Reef is sort of the flagship reef on the planet. And as it dies, it is sad. It creates havoc for the organisms that depend on the reefs for their livelihoods, for their existence, but it also interferes with economies. So reefs in the United States, for example, are responsible for conservatively $30 billion in revenue annually, and reefs globally between $175 and $375 billion annually. So the loss of reefs have huge devastating impacts for the organisms that live there because they don't have habitat, but also for economies.
Mm. And so you have hundreds of species of fish, sharks, dolphins, rays. All the plant life as well.
And those depend on the corals themselves. So the coral are the structural part of the reef. They're what provide all of the cracks and crevices for organisms to hide or find mates or find food or rest. And when the corals themselves start to die, that part erodes. And so the texture that is the reef is lost, and it becomes algal mat, or it could become just rubble, and then it's no longer suitable habitat for these thousands of species. And it's not just the ones we think of, like the fish and the sharks, but all of the invertebrates and the lobsters and snails and worms and all the critters that are part of that whole ecosystem.
And so have we already seen them go elsewhere? Many have died off, of course, but are they seeking habitats elsewhere?
Well, that's a really good question, and it is something we don't quite know. That certainly, you know, if the planet's getting warmer, one of the ideas is why won't reefs just migrate poleward, you know, farther north and farther south where it's not as hot? But we're not really seeing that, and it could be that the habitat isn't as good. There's some evidence that the maximum poleward migration or extent that reefs can exist is sort of where we are now. And it also could be that the rate at which the planet is warming is such that they cannot migrate fast enough. But all of these things combined make that we're not seeing any of that migration of those coral species elsewhere. And there's some evidence that they might not be able to. When you move poleward, you also get different daylight cycles and different seasonality to the water temperatures, which may mean that it's just not possible to go that much farther.
Andrea Grottoli, professor at Ohio State University, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up, some good news, finally. Our Friday film review segment. We have a couple of interesting documentaries to tell you about. And Ben Affleck starring as a pumped-up accountant-turned-assassin.
Kind of like if you mix Good Will Hunting with Jason Bourne and then put him on the autism spectrum.
Movie reviews next on Press Play.
Subscribe to KCRW's Today's Top Tune Download podcast. To receive a free song of the day, find today's top tune on KCRW's iTunes page.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It's Friday. If you need a break this weekend from the spectacle that is the presidential campaign, there are a lot of new films to check out. And here to talk about them, Alicia Malone, correspondent with Fandango. Hi.
Hello.
And Whitney Seibold, contributes to Crave Online and co-host of the B Movies podcast. Hello.
Glad to be here.
Great to have you. Let's start with The Accountant.
He has highly advanced cognitive skills. The obsessive personality.
Can our son lead a normal life?
Define normal. Maybe he's capable of much more than we know.
Okay, so it sounds like Ben Affleck is a superhero accountant. Is that right?
Yeah, kind of like if you mix Good Will Hunting with Jason Bourne and then put him on the autism spectrum at the same time. It's a really interesting mix. So he is an accountant who uncooks the books, as they say, for the most dangerous people on the planet. He's also very good with a sniper and with fighting. You know, there's a
How
lot going on.
How does he go from accountant to sniper?
With more ease than you would expect. It actually is less incongruous than you think. That's sort of, there are a lot of films about sort of assassins who are very business minded and all they want to do is go by their system, and it kind of makes sense to have an autistic character have those obsessive details that he needs to take care of. Cooking books, shooting people, it all kind of falls into place.
Without batting an eye.
And Ben Affleck is a capable enough performer to handle both pretty well. Although he's perhaps a little less convincing as somebody with autism, because Ben Affleck is a very gregarious dude. He seems a little too comfortable in his own skin to play a part sort of like this. But because you need a badass, he can pull it out.
So is he reprising Batman in some way?
Well, I think it's a great movie for him to play in between Batman, because it keeps him, you know, lithe and able to do these fighting. And you believe him as someone who could kick some butt. I think there's so much going on with this movie. It does feel quite overplotted at times. But I did like the fact when it goes to the flashbacks and it shows him and his father, and it shows how his father was the one that really instigated this style, you know, this instead of, you know, retracting from the world, you should fight your bullies and stand up to them. So that's a really interesting mix, I thought.
Although at the beginning of the third act, there are some ancillary characters played by J.K. Simmons and some other supporting characters as well. And right at the beginning of the third act, J.K. Simmons steps forward and begins to explain what his connection is as a law enforcer to this mysterious accountant that he's trying to track down. And the film crashes to a dead halt, and we have what feels like a full 10 to maybe even 15 minutes of flashback and exposition, which has nothing to do with Ben Affleck. And it kind of kills the film. Just the momentum stops. It becomes less interesting after that. You just have to sort of wait for the climax to occur at that point.
So, yes, no, I'm getting kind of mixed vibe here.
It is a mixed vibe, and I think it'll definitely divide audiences. I enjoy that this movie exists in this current Hollywood climate where there's so many derivative action heroes, that this is different, and I like that it's weird and it's silly and it's absurd. At the same time, it's definitely not a perfect movie. There's so many things that could have been tightened or fixed.
A bad script doesn't necessarily mean it's a bad idea.
Okay. All right, let's move on to something that is altogether weird. Shin Godzilla. This is just in theaters for a few days. Whitney, you've seen it.
Yes.
And tell us about this movie. Godzilla movie?
This is a Japanese Godzilla movie. Mm-hmm. This is now the second time that America, if you recall, America tried to make a Godzilla film in 2014.
Yes.
They previously tried to make a Godzilla film in 1998. And both times, Japan reacted to it by restarting the Godzilla franchises, trying to reclaim it as their own again. Godzilla is a national hero in Japan. He was, I think, recently named a cultural ambassador. So I think they're trying to sort of take it back from America, say, this is the real Godzilla franchise. Yours is the secondary one.
And is it the real one?
It's the real Godzilla. This is a very monstrous Godzilla. This is a Godzilla that flops out of the ocean at the beginning of the film, looking sort of like a gigantic fish monster with these big unthinking fish eyes. And it doesn't have a purpose. It just sort of flops around on land and mutates into this giant Godzilla thing, knocking over things in its path. Godzilla has previously been a metaphor for the atomic bomb.
Right.
Because he's this big nuclear monster. And I think enough time has passed that we can rejigger that thinking.
What is he a
metaphor
for now?
Now he's the Fukushima disaster.
Ah.
The sort of echo of a nuclear crisis that had recently happened. Most of Shin Godzilla is told from the perspective of great groups of people in boardrooms trying to decide what to do about this disaster. It's all very realistic and down to earth for Godzilla. You know, eventually, yes, Godzilla will unhinge his face and start blasting buildings with purple laser beams. But up until that point, it's all very terse and very austere and very bureaucratic.
And I think what I liked about the original Godzilla is that they're so cheesy and yet really fun.
If you look at the original Godzilla, it's actually a very dour film. It's very downbeat. The original 1954 right. Godzilla. It's not until you get into the 60s when he starts fighting creatures with
like Mothra.
Mothra mm-hmm. and Gigan and whatever the heck a Gigan is. Yeah, those, and you know, there's space aliens using mecha Godzillas to destroy the world. Those films are incredibly fun. I would never deprive anyone of those.
Is this in that tradition?
No, this one's a little bit more in the tradition of
the original,
the 1954 original. So it's a little bit more serious. It's a little bit more down to earth, but it's pretty astonishing to view because the silliness is still sort of there because it's still Godzilla. He carries a lot of baggage, but at the same time, they're still using him as sort of a serious dramatic construct, and that's very much appreciated.
Okay, from fantasy to reality, the next film is called Tower, and it combines archival footage, it's a documentary, and rotoscope animation. Here's a clip.
I just remember looking up at the sky. It was so blue. And just thinking, I guess this is it.
I guess this is the end.
One of history's worst mass murders occurred here in Austin today, and the full impact of today's tragedy still has not been felt because the magnitude of...
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is the true story of a sniper at the University of Texas back mm-hmm. in 1966. Yep. He killed more than a dozen people, wounded more than 30 people. This sounds pretty grim.
It is. It's quite a powerful documentary. I mean, this was the first ever American mass school shooting. And because it was the first time, no one knew what was going on. There was so much confusion. No one really understood that it was a sniper that was purposely trying to take out random people. Much like any other tragic circumstance, there are unlikely heroes that rise up. It's also a powerful tribute to the people that survived and people that were lost on that day. Also, a reminder of just how in 50 years now this has become almost a common occurrence that if you heard sniper shots and you're out somewhere, you would probably know what was going on. And that is so haunting. But the way that Keith Maitland, the director, mixes that animation with you heard the actor acting out the interview, then the real voice of the person, I love the way that he does that with the archival footage. It does make it a really absorbing cinematic experience and a documentary like no other. And this is one of my favorite documentaries of the year.
And the rotoscope, describe that, because maybe a lot of people don't know what that is.
Rotoscoping is when they film actual actors or yes. actual people, and then they animate over the film so that the movements and the colors match what's on the film.
So it's kind of, I was going to say, look like a filter that you would put on, you know, your Snapchat or,
right.
you know,
and
to
why
to
would
make
you do that
drawn.
Rather than just have the footage of the people you interview?
Well, a lot of the footage actually doesn't exist because it's showing okay. in real time what is happening, people getting shot. So there were a couple of cameras that arrived later onto the scene, but nothing actually happening. So I think they got the actors to act out what would have happened and then put it over the top.
Okay, let's talk about another, well, it sounds like a grim movie. It's based on a true event. It's Christine, the story of a televised suicide in 1974.
Good evening, Sarasota. I'm George Ryan.
Christine.
You and I have been working together for over a year now, and we've never gone out and had a drink together.
Well, you've never asked me.
You're not always the most approachable person.
Why don't you adjust your thinking? Christine, this isn't the start of one of your moods, is it?
Have you seen the flowers? They're fake! Sums up the whole operation!
Christine, go home!
So this is based on a true story. Christine Chubbuck actually committed suicide on TV.
Mm-hmm.
So how is this movie?
Yeah, 1974. So you know the true story. It's one of those films where you know how it's going to end. So it's so tense as it goes towards that inevitable conclusion. It's haunting, but it does have moments of brevity and comedy. But the thing that makes it so fascinating to watch is Rebecca Hall. She plays Christine Chubbuck, and gosh, she completely transforms into this role. I mean, I've always thought she was a brilliant actress. Here, she inhabits every single part of her, the little gestures, the way she felt uncomfortable in her skin, the hard edge she had, the rage that bottled underneath, the unrequited love with the guy she worked with, the girlish tendencies, and then, of course, the disillusionment with her news outlet that were going for more sensationalized news stories rather than actual, you know, in-depth reporting. And then she made herself into the literal if it bleeds, it leads.
Mm. Well, this also came out at the same time that a documentary about Christine came out.
Yeah,
at the same time, right?
That's
I think
right.
They both debuted at Sundance this year.
Yeah, Kate Plays Christine was the other one that showed at Sundance. So it was interesting that at this moment in time, we have these two movies about Christine Chubbuck. But I would say the pick is this one because of Rebecca Hall's performance. I mean, it's a small film, so I don't know whether it has the ability to campaign for Oscars, but I would love to see her awarded with something for this role because she is magnificent.
All right, we will end on an up note now with another documentary, and this one is about the artist Cai Kuo Shang, and he works in fireworks, actually. He is a fireworks artist, and here's a clip from the movie.
To say that the Chinese artist Cai Kuo Shang has exploded onto the contemporary art scene is no exaggeration.
He is really turning the idea of what art is on its head. And if you go as far as him, how do you challenge yourself?
And Whitney, this is called Sky Ladder because this is the installation that he has wanted to complete his entire life.
He has been going from city to city all around the world with this ambition of creating a very specific image with his fireworks, something that looks like a ladder. And in his own words, he wanted to connect the earth to the universe. Mm. And what it looks like is two gigantic blasts of sparks or smoke, I suppose, with rungs in between them. It looks exactly like a ladder.
Beautiful.
This is evidently a very complicated thing to make. The actual technicals of putting together something like this is pretty fascinating.
And I think a lot of us learned about him during the Beijing Olympics when he lit Beijing on fire with those incredible fireworks.
Yeah, the opening ceremony, he did that incredible fireworks display, which really put him on the map, made him famous.
Those little footprints.
Yeah, I love that. I also love how this documentary shows his work with the colored puffs of smoke, you know, the powder art. And it's just so dazzling to watch this documentary to see this kind of art, you know, being performed. And it's an interesting art form because it's something that's so impermanent, but it's something that really makes you feel something when you watch it.
This man's art exists for maybe a few moments, but if you're lucky enough to witness those few moments, you do witness this great transformative artistic experience.
And now forever in a documentary. But I loved watching his story. You know, I knew nothing about this artist, about the legacy of his father and how he was oppressed during the Cultural Revolution and then trying to restore his good name, also trying to battle with that idea of being very pragmatic and realistic, you know, as the state sponsors want him to be, which is what his art is anything but. Very inspiring and uplifting, literally, documentary.
Yeah, and so he has to really walk that balance, even though he now lives in New York. Mm-hmm. But he has to be careful because he has become so embraced by the Chinese government.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, it's a fine line when you add in the culture to everything that he's trying to do with his art form. And I thought that was fascinating.
Okay, Sky Ladder, go see it.
Yes.
Lots of good movies to see this week.
Yeah. Not necessarily fun movies, but pretty good movies.
Worth going out
worth
and spending
seeing.
The money.
Yeah.
I would say Godzilla is pretty fun.
Yeah. Godzilla's always fun. Even when he's not fun, he's fun.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
That's Whitney Seibold. He contributes to Crave Online, and he's co-host of the B-Movies podcast, and Alicia Malone is a correspondent with Fandango. And you can also watch the Dodgers tomorrow. We'll talk about their chances of going to the World Series and some other sports news with the Sklar brothers next on Press Play.
Check out KCRW's music blog for song premieres, music news, performances, and KCRW DJ features. You can keep up to date on all of KCRW's music happenings at kcrw.com/musicblog.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
The sound of a cheering crowd tells it all.
All right, you know what that means. It's time for sports with the Sklar brothers, Randy and Jason Sklar. Hi, you guys.
Hey, hello.
How are you?
Go Dodgers.
Go Dodgers. I mean, look, they don't want Vin Scully to stop. You know, they're
right.
Like, we're going to keep the run
Let's
going.
Let's out of retirement.
Come on.
Just
how that
for
was
the
an
next
amazing
few weeks.
Game yesterday. Amazing game.
Longest 9-inning game in the history of the playoffs.
Really?
Yeah.
Four hours. 4-3.
Dodgers are moving on. They are going to play the Chicago. They have to go to Chicago because Chicago had a better record. They're going to play. They don't have home field advantage, but they play the
tomorrow.
Chicago Cubs. Yeah. And the Cubs are amazing. We'll talk about them later. But right now, let's shine the light on how great and how important of a series this was for
the organization.
The organization, and specifically Clayton Kershaw.
Okay. The guy who is much maligned in the postseason. He is one of the best regular season pitchers
we've seen. People are saying he's the Sandy Koufax of our generation, and his numbers actually bear that out. He is the run he's had in the last several years.
In the regular season.
In the regular season has been historic. I mean, it's unbelievable, his numbers. They're unbelievable.
But when he gets to the postseason, especially against the St. Louis Cardinals, around the seventh inning of games that he's pitched, even when he's brilliant in the first six innings, he'll have a meltdown.
Hmm.
And it's kind of been his MO. So last night, he came in on a day's rest and pitched the final two outs.
Dave Roberts, the manager of the Dodgers, really managed a brilliant game. And he showed why the Dodgers went out and got him. In the seventh inning, his pitcher's not doing it, and he brings in his closer, the guy who really is only supposed to pitch, Kenley Jansen, only supposed to pitch the ninth inning. He doesn't normally go two innings,
mm-hmm.
but they put him in the seventh inning in hopes that he would take it to the end. And he almost did, but that's unheard of. He actually pitched more pitches in that game than Kenley Jansen has in his entire pro career in one game. So like that was just an incredible, he did something that they'd never
done
chance. Before. And Clayton Kershaw in the seventh inning went to Dave Roberts and said, I'm going to loosen up, because he wanted that ball at the very end. He wanted that redemption of the fact, give me the ball. If this guy falters, I will take the ball. And he came in. Normally, this guy throws about 93, 94 miles an hour. He was throwing fastballs 95 miles an hour. And then he's got to face Daniel Murphy on the Washington Nationals. Murphy last year with the Mets took Kershaw in the playoffs deep twice. And really is a nemesis of his. He was having a great season this year, and Kershaw jams him and gets him to pop up and make an out, and is one of the last two outs.
And this is with a couple bases loaded.
Couple runners on base, tying
run. And then he gets a strikeout to end the game, which is how every pitcher wants to end a game five or a deciding
game. It was amazing because the little bit of drama, ball was in the dirt. Ruiz had to throw him out at first after the strikeout, but Kershaw pitched the strikeout and then thrust his hands in the air. It was just such a great moment for him. You could see the catharsis, the weight lifted off. And for him to have won, basically the Dodgers won all three games in which he had pitched. Now, of course, they face a monumental task playing what many consider to be the best team in baseball.
Okay, they're facing the Cubs, and Kershaw will not play tomorrow, right?
He won't. He will not pitch tomorrow. I do not think they will. I think they'll rest him. And it's a seven-game series. You have a chance if you pitch him in game two or three.
Maeda is going to pitch tomorrow. And the Cubs are they're rested. They have a deep team. They have an amazing team. They beat the Giants, a team of destiny.
This was the Giants' even year. The Giants should have gone, but the Cubs actually came back in two games, almost beat them in one, and then beat them in the other game. And the Cubs are just resilient. They're like, curse be damned, because the curse of the Billy Goat. So
why is it called the curse of the Billy Goat?
Because
we even want to get into.
We don't have to.
It's not even worth getting into. Just know that they haven't won a World Series since 1908,
and they haven't gone to the World Series since 1945.
That's right. And so now you have in the American League, you've got Cleveland. Now, Cleveland, as a city, the Cavaliers won this year, and you cannot call Cleveland a loser city anymore because they have a championship in a major sport. The last time Cleveland won the World Series was 1948. So you're talking about 68 years or 108 years. If those two teams could meet each other in the World Series, someone's going to break a curse that's either 68 years or 108 years long. And it just, to me, would be great for baseball. If Cleveland wins, then they are a city that has won the NBA championship and the World Series in the same year. That would be historic. If the Cubs win, I mean, Chicago, I don't even know what's going to happen in
Chicago.
Sounds
like you guys are rooting for Chicago. What?
You know, we're Cardinals fans.
Come on.
Look,
I'm not rooting for the Cubs. I'm rooting for what's good for the sport. And I think if the Cubs were in the World Series, that would be amazing. But the Dodgers as well have a great
story.
Great story and a great team. And Clayton Kershaw in the World Series had a chance at being a champion is a great story, too. So I actually think there's really no scenario that's a bad scenario moving into the World Series in baseball.
Okay, let's move on to football. The Rams have won 3 games and they've lost 2. So that's a pretty good record for what's considered the worst offense in the NFL.
Yeah, worst offense in the NFL. What,
how does that happen?
Because their defense is so good and they have a great running back, Todd Gurley, and they've gotten a couple of great bounces. They played some teams when they were down. And
look, they beat Seattle and no one scored a touchdown in the game. They won 9-3.
Yeah.
Like that shows you how good of a defense LA has. And look, you know, the Rams weren't coming here saying we're going to be in the playoffs. They were like, we're going to just be happy you have a team right now. But the reality
is the bar is low. I mean, you know, people are excited that the Rams are here. They're excited there's NFL football in Los Angeles. Sundays have a different feel to it because there is an NFL team here.
And like, we're not even in the stadium yet. They're playing in the Coliseum. They're not even in their
but
new
the
home.
Rams, there's been a formula kind of in the NFL that is sort of a bunch of teams have adopted.
About 10 years ago, it was all about the quarterback.
All about the quarterback. If you had a good quarterback, that was what would carry you to the playoffs. Now, it's like if you have a good defense and a good running back and a good run, meaning you can, you know, sort of control possession of the game and time of possession, you can beat teams.
And their fancy new quarterback, Jared Goff, hasn't played yet.
Which, by the way, is fine. I don't think there are a lot of rookie quarterbacks who can come into this league. It's so much faster than college. It's so much more complicated than
you
college.
You want him to learn. You want him to watch and learn and take his time.
And because they're here in Los Angeles and the Rams fans aren't saying we haven't had a championship in so long, there is more time to develop. So I think Rams management is very excited right now that they're 3-2 and in second place in their division, and you never know what can happen.
Well, here's something that's a little weird. After they play their game on Sunday, they're going to London to play.
So the NFL has made a huge push to try and make the game more international, and there's been a big turnouts in London for the games. It's exciting.
You know, I think they are trying to grow this league in an international way, and they are doing it.
I think the logical end to this experiment is to eventually have a team in London. I think that's a possibility.
What would you call it?
I don't know.
The London Gentlemen.
Yeah.
The London League of
Teetotalers.
You call them the London Fog. Everybody's wearing these great jackets.
Trench coats.
And
they're looking dapper on the field.
I don't know. Then you have a Scottish team, the Loch Ness Monsters.
The Sherlock Holmes.
There you go.
The Benedict Cumberbatches.
I would watch that.
Benedict Cumberbatches.
Everyone would watch that.
Yes, because he's so dangerous.
The Upton Abbeys. We can keep going.
We can just go
on and on and on. The Portobello Roads. Yes.
What?
Such a specific market.
The Brixton Markets. Okay. Fine. We're done.
You're not done.
Okay.
The Clash.
Okay. Just call it The Clash.
Okay. Yeah,
right, we'll right. keep going.
The Joe Strummers. Okay, done. Stop it. Sklar Brothers. The Sklar Brothers. How about that?
I would love that.
That would be fantastic.
Good for our brand.
Sklar Brothers. Randy, Jason Sklar. Check them out on the show Those Who Can't on True TV. The Jolie Myers.
Perfect name for a football team in
is
London.
Is in the house. Yeah, exactly. It's your British accent. Just gives you away.
I was thinking that the Ringo Stars would be fun.
That's a good one.
Is
How
it?
About the Marmites?
Well, that would be the Sydney-based NFL team, right? Marmite's an Australian thing, isn't it?
Vegemite.
They mentioned
I think you're thinking about Vegemite.
Marmite
is British, and there's a whole Brexit story with Marmite perhaps not being made anymore. I mean, it's an international
Send
crisis.
Send us all of your condiment-based pitches and hot tips, please, and also send us your ideas for European-based NFL football teams. What would the Paris team be called? Milan. Sweden.
The Zoutalors.
The Zoutalors.
Okay.
Is it a little too gauche for Paris? No. The answer is no.
That's nice. Gosh, I get it. Okay. All right. Julie Myers, thank you very much. Have a great weekend. You have a great weekend. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you Monday.
Support for Press Play comes from the Kane Foundation. Rick and Suzanne Kane and Jenny, Maggie, and Sari Kane.